Welcome to the Creative Agency Account Manager Podcast. I'm Jenny Plant, and I'm on a mission to help account managers understand the agency business and develop an entrepreneurial mindset in their role so they can show up as a commercially aware advisor to their clients rather than a reactive order taker. Welcome to episode 109. Today's guest is a management consultant who has been looking at the agency business model for over 30 years. He's identified three burning issues for creative agencies. Number one, scopes of work are increasing in volume and yet agencies' fees are declining. But because agencies aren't measuring scopes of work, they don't often realize the extent to which this is happening. Number two, agencies aren't helping clients achieve their business outcomes. Clients are paying them less and typically fire them every 3 years, and also generally treat them as order takers. And number three, AI is now putting fuel on this fire and is threatening to reduce the amount of creative adaptation work that agencies do. Now, it's not all doom and gloom, but I found this an enlightening conversation, and I particularly enjoyed listening to the history of how it was before agencies priced their services by the hour. Michael talks about the problems, but he also offers solutions. So let's go over to the introduction now. Today, I'm absolutely delighted to introduce Michael Farmer. Michael is chairman and CEO of Farmer & Company, a New York-based strategy consultant firm that advises ad agencies and their clients on their business relationship issues, particularly those involving scopes of work. Michael is the author of Madison Avenue Manslaughter, Madison Avenue Makeover, and over 100 published articles about the advertising industry. Michael was previously a director of Bain & Company, responsible for Bain's Munich, Paris, and London offices. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Jenny, thank you so much. I'm quite honored to be invited to your show and to have this opportunity to talk to your listeners.
Well, I am absolutely delighted. As we said before we started recording, I've read your book cover to cover, which I have here, the latest one. And it's very dog-eared, as you can see, because lots of notes have been made. So I'm ready with my questions and I can't wait to get into them.
Oh, shoot.
Okay, let's start with the problem with the agency business model, Michael. You've been analysing agency scopes of work for 30 years, and you've uncovered a raging fire that's destroying the agency's business model. Could you elaborate on your findings?
Yes, it's such an interesting phenomenon, Jenny, because, you know, it was in 1992 when I had just left Bain in the United Kingdom and started my own consulting firm. I really wanted to get back into the nuts and bolts of consulting instead of, you know, running an organization of 350 people. Anyway, and so within a very short period of time, I was asked by Ogilvy UK if I could help them. They had recently been bought by WPP in one of the early acquisitions Martin Sorrell made. I think it was basically a second big acquisition in 1989. And 1990, 1991, 92 were sort of recession years in the UK, and the advertising business was down. And Ogilvy was feeling a lot of pressure about delivering the numbers that WPP required of its acquired agencies. And they were having trouble and couldn't figure out why their profitability was slinking and what could be done about it. And that's a typical assignment for a strategy consulting firm, as opposed to someone that is an expert in the agency business. So I took the assignment for Mike Walsh, who was the chairman and CEO then. And I said, look, Mike, I don't know anything about the agency business, but I'm going to do what I normally do when I study a business. There are three things I need over the past 5 years. I need to know how much stuff you do for your clients. You know, what do you produce? What do you make? You make ads. I need to know what ads you do and what type of ads they are over the last 5 years for each of your 20 clients or so. I need to know how much you're paid for that. And I need to know how many people it takes to do it. And, you know, from that, with all that data, generally, you can uncover what has changed in the last 5 years. You know, once we were profitable, now we are not. And he thought that was a great idea, as long as I never said an agency is a factory that makes ads, which is what I was thinking, of course. What I was surprised to find is that there were no records of what they did for their clients, at least not in a in a management file. They couldn't look at Ford Motor Company, which was a big client, and say, oh, this is what we're doing for Ford. This is what we've done the last 5 years. You could find that stuff in job jackets where they paid invoices for photographers and, you know, various costs. But there wasn't a management sheet anywhere that kept track of the output. And so instead of jumping in to get 5 years worth of data, we spent something like 7 weeks trying to reconstruct what the work was in 1992 alone. And we did figure it out, and we figured a way of how to measure it, like how many pounds or how many kilos of work is this, or how many calories. There was no unit measurement, so we had to invent one. But we were able to do that. And the bottom line was, you know, coming out of the commission era, they just had too many people for the work they were doing. And that wasn't the kind of thing they looked at, and they didn't have any measure of the work anyway. So once they right-sized themselves in 1992, their profits went from 5% to 14%, and they were back in the good graces of WPP. Now, look, I only did that because I needed it to be smart about the agency business. It wasn't like this was a product that I was going to sell. But I did realize that if we had done this for one office at Ogilvy, that maybe all the other offices had the same problem. And maybe every agency that we might work with, Gray, YNR, JWT, any of the others, maybe they all have the same problem. And so we went investigating, and it turned out that they're all kind of in the same situation. Nobody kept track of work. And we worked for Ogilvy for another 5+ years around Europe. Later, we were hired by Gray, first in the UK, and then we did that work around Europe and in South America and in New York. And it was always the same thing. We were gathering whatever data we could get on scopes of work. We were measuring it, and we were figuring out whether they had too few or too many resources. During the first 10 years of my consulting work, we found agencies that had surplus resources. And now, bear in mind that the fire that you talk about that's burning up agencies is even to today, 30+ years later, I have yet to encounter any agency in any country that kept track of scope of work or the size of scopes of work by client so that agencies could charge the right fees and put the right number of people against it. And what's actually happened in the business is that by 2005, all of the surplus resources from the commission era were gone. And yet, agencies were still downsizing every year to make their margins for the holding company, and they have continued to do that. It's very hard to pick up a copy of Campaign or Ad Week or Ad Age or The Drum or any of the other great trade magazines without reading about another downsizing. And their big downsizing is in January, because that's when budgets get set and people running the agencies realize they're never going to make the numbers that are required with today's staffing. So they're all going through big downsizings, everything from S4 Capital to BBDO to Gray to Ogilvy and the rest of the WPP gang. So I thought, this is terrible. How can you run an operation that is labor-based, that is making thousands of materials, creative materials and strategic materials for clients, and not know how much work you're doing? How is it that you can accept fees from clients every year and not know how much work you're going to do for the fees? And this became particularly acute when procurement entered the picture in the after, you know, commissions went away and labor-based fees came in. Clients added procurement people to kind of unsnarl the agency fees. And they thought that agencies were way overpaid and that the fees could be cut. So procurement has been cutting fees every year for the last 20 years. And marketing departments have been raising the scopes of work with digital and social executions so that you've got growing workloads, declining fees, and downsizings. And I've argued that the downsizings represent a liquidation of the agency intellectual and creative capital. So agencies are liquidating themselves to make margins for the holding company, and they're not doing anything about the fact that workloads are growing and fees are coming down, and they're paid on the basis of a guess at man hours, not at actual quantities of work. So that was Madison Avenue manslaughter, 3 editions in 15, 17, and 19. And guess what? The book very widely sold, lots of compliments, and nobody did anything about it except ultimately Matt Baxter at Huge, which, you know, represents my second book, Madison Avenue Makeover. So long answer to your first question.
No, listen, you covered all the points that I had written down, so thank you. Before we get to the success story of Matt, I want to step back one step. You said something there that some listeners may not be aware of. So you talked about coming out of the commission era. Pricing, obviously, for agencies is so key, the way we price. We swapped from the commission era to a labor-based pricing model. And do you think, first of all, before I ask you, maybe for the listeners that are of a younger generation, they don't remember that far back, can you just explain how we charged for our services then and then what happened?
Yes, good question, Jenny, because listen, you really have to go back a long way to understand what an incredible transformation it was to change the way the industry priced. If we go back, almost the original pricing for agencies was a client spends X number of thousands or millions of dollars on media, whatever the media is. It could be television time. It could be a newspaper space, magazine space, or radio time, right? But whatever the client spent on that media, agencies got 15% of it. And that 15% was meant to cover all the media planning and buying by the media planners and buyers at the time, and all the creative work. So, you know, let's just take a hypothetical situation. A client spent $100 million across television, radio, and print back before, let's say, 1980. Okay? Agencies got $15 million to do whatever the client wanted done. And let me tell you, relative to how much work the agencies were doing, that was a massive amount of money. It was risk-free. They didn't have to negotiate anything. The only thing they had to worry about was, are we the agency of record? And how much money is the client spending? Everything else took care of itself. And of course, when TV got to be big in the 50s and the 60s, and it was the most expensive media, clients are spending a huge amount of money on television time, and the agencies loved doing TV scripts and shooting TV commercials because they really worked. They worked in the 50s and the 60s. So agencies made so much money that it was embarrassing. And they also were so successful and so risk-free that they went public in the 60s. Now, the 60s is a long time ago, right? 40 plus 25, you know, it's 65 years ago. And in order for their clients not to know how much money they could make or their shareholders, agencies staffed up. In other words, they had twice the number of people that they needed. That way, they only showed a 10 or 15% profit margin instead of a 30, 40 or 50% profit margin. If they had shown the marketplace how much money they could make with a normal staff, the clients would have surely cut the commission rate from 15 to 10 or something like that, or even 5, which is about where it is today. So agencies got used to running a risk-free business. The money was automatic, and they had more resources than they needed, and they could work it and work it and work it until they got it right. In fact, BBDO's motto was the work, the work, the work. We don't worry about how much rework we have. We don't worry about how many changes there are and what you want done. We will do it for you. Well, what that meant was we've got enough people to do 3 times the amount of work we're doing. Okay. They got bought by holding companies in the 80s. And the holding companies, knowing that they were overstaffed, said, look, if we take out those resources, the profits will go up. The holding company margin will go up. The holding company shares will go up. And we can continue to buy agencies at cheaper rates. And, you know, Martin Sorrell did that. John Dooner was the head of Interpublic. He did it. John Wren did it at Omnicom, et cetera, et cetera. So they got used to buying agencies, downsizing them because there were surplus resources and driving up the share price and then continuing to buy. I call it the buy and squeeze strategy that went on from the 80s right up to 2005. When all the surplus resources were gone, but they just continued going. Now, somewhere in the 90s and 2000s, the clients decided they weren't going to work on the commission basis anymore. Instead, they were going to pay agencies for the man hours they put into the client work based on how many people they have. And generally, they were saying, well, the average agency person puts in 1,800 hours a year. You know, so if there are 10 agency people on the account, then it's, you know, 18,000 hours that we're going to pay a certain hourly rate for, and we're going to throw in overhead and the profit margin for the agencies. But what it did to move to hourly rates is it got the clients involved in understanding how much agency people were paid, how many people were on the account, how much overhead was involved in agency operations, what kind of profit margins they needed. In other words, all of a sudden, clients who only used to worry about how much money they spent on media were now spending money on media and also getting involved in agency economics. And that's when they hired procurement people who they thought were pretty smart about how to do that. And once they did that, and agencies weren't very good at responding about, well, how many people do you really need to do this work? The procurement people said, it's obvious they got something to hide. We're just going to cut fees. So I'm going to say my work between, let's say, 1992 and about 2002, you know, for the first 10 years, I helped agencies downsize, get rid of the last of their surplus resources. And I knew what was surplus because I knew how much work they were doing. By 2005, I was announcing to the world, hey, the surpluses are gone. Now agencies need to charge for the work they're doing and not for the man hours. And nobody paid attention to that, of course. And so they continued to downsize. Procurement kept cutting fees. And that goes on to this day. So procurement has never stopped cutting fees, and agencies have never stopped downsizing throughout this whole, you know, 30 plus years that I've been doing this business, except that the no more surplus resources, and they're taking out their most senior and most expensive and most experienced people. I think it's a disaster. And that's why I wrote Madison Avenue Manslaughter. That's what the book is all about.
So I'm interested in the market's reaction, the agency owner's reaction to this. Most of my listeners are independent agency owners, and you could argue that they have a little bit more of a control over how they price, how they run their businesses. But what you're saying is we've got increasing volumes of work, we've got decreasing fees, we've got procurement taking more of an interest in how we run our businesses, and we are turning into this kind of factory of churning out things and trying to keep our heads above water. My question is, do you find that agency owners actually understand this current business model decline? And is there a willingness to accept and address the problem?
I think the industry, the independent agencies with their, you know, owner, manager, CEOs understand this better than holding company agencies. However, what they are up against is the pricing practices and the attitudes of procurement and the attitudes of chief marketing officers are definitely set by the big holding company agencies. So the practices of the clients are the real constraint here. And of course, I've worked with many independent agencies. And listen, they get this. They say, we would love to be able to price, you know, on the basis of the work we're doing, the amount of work that we're doing. The problem is we're getting the dribs and drabs of what gets left over, often in holding company relationships, and we're sort of held to the same standard, and procurement wants to know how much we pay our people and what's our overhead rate and what our profit margin is. And we have to change the attitudes of our clients because, listen, the pricing practices are the client's pricing practices, not ours. This is a crazy thing about the industry where the buyer of the services is determining what the provider can charge. You know, you can't go to Best Buy and buy a computer. You can't determine, you can't tell them how you want to pay for it other than what credit card you're going to use. You sort of accept what the supplier is going to provide for you. But this is an industry where, because having an agency relationship is so important for the agencies and the holding companies, they'll do anything to hang on to it. And therefore, they will accept the practices of their clients as determining how they will charge for their services. Actually, Jenny, that's what I am up against here is that some agents say, I'd love to do this, but you know, if I try to change the pricing practices and I'm up against all the other agencies that aren't doing that, there's a good chance I'm going to lose out. particularly if I'm being underpaid. If I'm being underpaid and I go to the client and say, hey, you know, I've been working with Farmer and he tells me that we're being underpaid by 30% and here's how much work we're doing and here's what we would like to charge for it. And it looks like we need 30% more money, or we need to cut the scope of work by 30% and we'll keep the fee. Client might say, you know, I can get someone to do this work who will charge me less. I don't need the story. So I think that the practices that are built into procurement and chief marketing officers are a major constraint. That's one. And I also think that the agencies, whether they're holding companies agencies or independent agencies, are very risk averse these days because keeping a client is harder today than it ever was. And the relationships are shorter. So we're up against risk aversion on one side and rigid procurement and pricing practices on the other side.
In some respects, it sounded like there needed to be some redress of the balance from 30 years ago, because clearly the agencies were having a great time 30 years ago. Something had to give, but it feels like from everything you've described, it swung so far the other way. Tell me what you think agencies need to do differently now to put themselves in the right position. So if their biggest concern is other agencies are still playing the game and procurement are going to choose them, how can an agency stand out? And maybe this is a good point to bring in the case with Matt Baxter and what he saw
as... Yes, it is. Well, look, Jenny, let's imagine a client relationship that has, let's say, one holding company agency and an independent agency working on it. They don't really work together. Maybe they have different disciplinary skills, but it doesn't much matter. Let's imagine that both of those agencies now know how much work they're doing. Okay. And they know how much they're being paid on the old basis. And it's a, you know, it's a price per man hour. But it's, let's say the holding company agency is getting $5 million and the independent agency is getting $1 million. And, you know, I measure scopes of work in scope metric units. I have a unit of work that is like, it's like the size of a typical TV commercial, a typical TV origination spot, okay? So a scope, an SMU, a scope metric unit, I measure all of them in sort of TV equivalents. So what you could do for each of those clients, you got a $5 million relationship and a $1 million relationship, you could divide the $5 million relationship by the number of SMUs for the holding company agency and say, the existing price per SMU is, and let's make up a number, $125,000. And you could take the $1 million relationship and divide it by the number of SMUs that exist in the independent agency scope of work and come up with a number. Let's say it's $100,000 per SMU. They could go to their clients and say, look, we don't want to charge on a man-hour basis anymore. We want to charge on Farmer systems, scope metric units. You can read all about it in Madison Avenue Manslaughter. But the fee doesn't change. We're just changing the denominator in the equation. It isn't man hours anymore. It's SMUs. And this is how the SMU system works. And what we would like to do going forward, we'll do that for 2024. No change in fee, no change in scope of work. We're going to do the same work that you wanted us to do. We're doing it for the same fee. We're using the same number of people. Both agencies would say that. And then they would say, when we come to doing the 2025 scope of work, together we will sit down and using the Farmer scope metric system, we will calculate together how many scope metric units are in the new scope of work, and we'll sit down and negotiate what the price should be. Now, what I would expect is if this is a successful negotiation, it'll be tough this year, but no tougher than what they're already doing. In subsequent years, I think agencies will want to raise the price per SMU to a level where they actually can have the right number of people working on the scope, or they cut the number of deliverables and therefore the SMUs from the scope of work to keep the fees where the clients want them. But I think that is the most painless way of shifting from man hours to some other basis, and let's call that productization. And the reason I think that's really essential is that I believe that artificial intelligence can easily take out 20% of the man hours that are currently being billed, 20% of the man hours. And that could be 20% of the revenue, which no agency, independent or otherwise, could suffer. So I think there is a huge urgency, more urgent than what I've been yapping about for 30 years. I mean, I've been on this, you've got to start charging for the work, not some guesstimate at man hours. That's what I've been saying for 30 years. And everyone says, you're right, Mike, but you know, we can't do that. Well, now I think they have to do it or they're at risk of losing a big piece of their man hours and their income. And it will destroy the holding companies to lose 20% of their income. WPP has admitted that 75% of their income is man hour based. 75 already. I mean, I think they were, what they really said is 25% of our revenue is already based on something else. Well, okay, 75% is man hour based. And, you know, if it were 20% of that, that would be 15% of their, you know, income. So I think AI is really a firestorm today, and we need to get into a different form of billing. And the interesting thing about what Matt Baxter did at Huge was to say from the get-go, we're going to charge for the products we offer, not for man hours anymore. And he created a whole suite of products with fixed prices that would allow that. So he called it productization, and it was meant to cover every single piece of business they did in the future once they completed their transformation at the end of 22. The formal part of the transformation at the end of 22. I mean, it goes on every day.
I'm just going to ask you a side question, and I've got so many more questions, but it's been asked to ask you, was there any resistance from the creative side? I understand from the book that the creative director left quite quickly and another creative director came in to continue the productization exercise. I'm just wondering, you know, this concept of productization, a lot of creative people are in it for the craft. Maybe their priority is not so much on the commercial side. I mean, some are, some aren't. But in general, do you find that there's a different receptiveness to this concept of productization?
No. And listen, I think the concept of creativity as it has been touted for the last 30 years, as if it's, you know, an agency's an art gallery and, you know, an ad is a painting on the wall, for which, you know, it's judged for its aesthetic features, is never what was meant as the purpose of an agency. In fact, if you go back to the golden age of advertising, 1960, when the Volkswagen ad was, you know, done by DDB, and Bill Birnbach was viewed as the guy who created the concept of almost art for art's sake, you know, in television ads, the Avis commercials, the Volkswagen commercials. And yet, if you go back to what Bill Birnbach said, he said that, and I can find the quote, he said that anyone who thinks that this work is not to generate sales for our clients doesn't understand the business and should leave. That's Bill Birnbach. And David Ogilvy said, we sell or else. And he encouraged creatives to be steeped in research about the client's products. Now, what has happened is that this idea that creativity solves all problems, we don't need to worry about what the client's brand problems are or any of that other thing, that if we generate creative ads, they will solve all problems. Excuse me, that is just bullshit.
Yeah.
And it wasn't meant by any of the great creatives of the era. During the golden age, it wasn't meant by Leo Burnett. It wasn't meant by David Ogilvy, George Lois, Bill Birnbach. It wasn't meant by any of them. Somehow agencies, and maybe this has something to do with the way awards are generated and the way clients now pick agencies, but they never were in the business of saying, look, we're in the business of helping clients perform better, and we bring to bear our brilliant creativity and anything else that we have to bring. Today, that would be technology. Today, this would be analysis of customer segments and targeting and everything else. But let's just call all of that stuff technology. So you have, and you know, I'm very hard on Burger King, which is one of the worst performing fast food chains in the world and has been forever. It is the most creatively awarded brand, and its agencies most creatively awarded, and yet Burger King every year, its sales per restaurant barely grow compared to McDonald's and many others. It's sort of number 20 in the industry when it used to be number 3 15 years ago. So, you know, the wonderful ads that have thrilled Cannes audiences that were pure creativity makes no sense. In my understanding and in my experience, creatives get my concept better than account people. They say, of course, this work is meant to accomplish something. It's not art for art's sake. But go to any agency website and they'll talk about the awards they've won and how great their creative is and every year how they're trying to improve their creativity. They never say the purpose of our creativity is to drive brand performance improvements for our clients. And in fact, most agencies are not briefed about what the client problems are. That's another thing that I'm going to include in my next book. As I look at brand strategic plans that clients have, they change their agency so often that they won't share those brand strategic plans. So how can an agency be a strategic partner if they don't even know what the brand problems that need to be solved are? I mean, you know, they depend on being briefed properly by clients about the work. Agencies generally do not participate in creating the scopes of work. They do the scope. I'm talking about creative agencies now. Where creative agencies are given scopes of work by clients. They're told generally how much they will be paid for it. And they're generally told how many people they will be paid for. And then they say, yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, we'll do that. But they don't say, you know, I can come up with a better scope of work, different deliverables that I think would do a much better job for the brand performance. Do you know, Jenny, that the top 20 advertisers, I'm talking about in spend, grew less than 2% per year, less than GDP over the last 13 years, including Procter & Gamble, Unilever, Colgate-Palmolive, and Nestle, among many, Bank of America, many, many others. So, you know, all of these bloated scopes of work that are being given to agencies who are trying to be creative are not delivering work that is actually working. So what I say is, don't talk to me about creativity for creativity's sake. Talk to me about creativity as focused and mobilized for brand performance. Well, agencies will say, well, that's not what our relationship is all about. Right. That's the problem that needs to be solved. So the relationships need to be changed so that agencies are partners to work on brand performance problems, to bring their creativity and their technology to bear, and for them to come up with scopes of work that they think does a better job than maybe what they're given by their clients. I'm on a rant about that one because I think that agencies are stuck in a situation where it's very hard for them to succeed. And part of it is their own making, the romanticism about creativity. Part of it is that their clients, part of it is that the two of them have a system that doesn't work. So that needs to be fixed.
Well, there's a mismatch of needs, isn't there? The client needs the agency to solve their problem quickly, and the agency kind of needs to bill more hours to make money. So there's a fundamental difference in incentive.
Yeah, but you're back to talking hours, Jenny, and that hours bad, product good.
Product good. And I know a lot of agencies are either looking at or moving to a productized offering.
Well, they say they are. I haven't seen much, but I hear the talk.
Okay, well, I'm working with an agency at the moment who is actually on this journey, but I'd love to talk to you about it afterwards. So let's talk about some solutions, because we've got increasing scopes, falling fees, clients' businesses aren't growing, they're not sharing their business challenges with us so that we can address them. You said earlier on, creatives get this more than account management. I train account management for a living. Talk to me about how you've seen account management change over the last 30 years.
Yes. Well, you know, that's like the pricing thing. I think back in the day, before there were strategic planners, before there were project management people, and before there was any digital or social advertising, and before there were fees for man hours, if we go back to account people during the commission era, their main job was to make sure that clients spent more on media, period. That was their job. Because I, you know, my consulting experience goes back that far. They worked the client from the chairman of the board down to the assistant product manager. They were out there saying, you know, if you spend more on television, if you spend more on print and radio, it will drive brand growth. We will give you the material. You know, we're very creative. And listen, I think agencies did really great work in those days. They could afford to do so, and they didn't have to do a lot of work. They weren't doing a huge number of commercials. They wanted to do a few number of commercials that ran and ran and ran because they made a 15% commission every time a client spent money on media. So the account people, they were totally wired in to what made a brand grow. And their belief was the more you spend on media, the more advertising we can do with our creative capabilities and the faster the brand will grow. And, you know, listen, it's no secret that P&G, which was the world's most successful advertiser back in those days, they outspent their competitors 2-1 on a case-to-case basis because they really believed that the spend on media and the creative stuff that they got from Gray and from the publicist agencies really generated work. And it did for Tide and Pampers and Pringles. And you think about all the great P&G brands that were established by massive media spend and account people that really kept their eye on brand sales and talked clients into spending more on. Now, when we shifted away from commissions into the other thing, the bad thing, the man hour billing, all of a sudden that pulled the rug out from underneath the account people because they couldn't say spend more. It didn't do a thing for the agency to spend more. And what they should have done then, you know, this is the shoulda, coulda, woulda. What they should have done was shifted the dialogue and started to keep track in a different way of how much work they were doing against the brand and what was the nature of the work. And then particularly after 2005, when we had digital and social coming in, taking a look at that scope of work. But somehow scope of work never entered the equation, and account people, when it went from commission to man hour billing, shifted to services. No longer aggressors irritating every people, you know, at the client by saying, spend more, spend more, spend more, knowing that they were going to get more and more income. They couldn't do that anymore. So they became servicers. And then strategic planners came in and took away part of their responsibilities for strategic planning. And then later, when the workloads got to be huge, project managers came in and took some more of that stuff. And right now, I think, you know, a typical client person is someone that hangs on to the client and services the client, gives the client what the client wants. And that is such a different role than they were in the 70s and the 80s when they were such aggressive salesmen. I mean, all you have to do is watch Mad Men to see, you know, how aggressive it was. And let's not forget that John Hamm in his role was a creative, not an account person. Mm-hmm. And he was always trying to get the clients to spend more. Creatives did it, and so did the account people. But that's not the case today. So listen, account people have got today to be a lot more like Bain consultants. I can only speak to this because as a director at Bain and had three different offices in Europe over time to worry about, the one thing that we always did was to ensure that the work that we did for a client would address a performance issue so that our work solved problems. And if it was successful, you stayed forever. And if it wasn't, you got fired. And Bain tended to stay with its clients for a very long time. Agencies used to stay with their clients for a very long time. You know, JWT worked for Ford for 40 years. They got fired some years ago, and there are other people doing the work at Ford, and the typical relationship's only 3 years now. So it's become transactional rather than strategic. It's become cost-based and service-based instead of promoting brand performance. It's been, you know, all of these things taken together, the big system has just stopped working. And I think that that problem needs to be recognized and fixed at a very macro level.
I so agree with you. And what you just said about account managers need to be more consultative, it's what I do. I talk about this all day, every day. The problem I face with account managers is they don't have time or capacity to be consultative. They don't want to be salesy because they're quite service-led and they're from a service background. They're not consultative. They don't know how to look at a client's business to identify the problems that we're fixing. So there's a culmination of lots of different things as a result of this labor-based pricing.
Yeah, well, Jenny, that should give you a very a big market to address with your consulting services, because I don't accept the fact that they are inherently incapable of this. Look, young people that we used to hire at Bain didn't know anything about consulting, and yet we could train them over the years to do what, you know, the kind of stuff that I had to do and other people had to do. But listen, here's the thing. When you are working on something as sensitive as improving performance, you have to push. You got to push the client. You have to push them to accept very often a definition of a problem that they haven't seen before. And the only way you can do that is to get better data than the data they're using. So, you know, listen, let's talk about Bain, McKinsey, BCG, A.T. Kearney, or any of these other great firms, can't get away with just having opinions. When they say this is what you should do and this is why you should do it, the part which is this is why you should do it is through a mastery of data on pricing, consumer behavior, cost position, competitive analysis, and a lot of other stuff, often using data that comes from the client, but the client's overlooking. You know, I learned from the time I got out of business school and worked through the consulting firms, I learned that clients have got a lot of the data that would solve their problems. They just don't look at it because they're so busy running things. Now, the problem that agencies have is they don't get their hands on that data and they don't try to develop it independently. So a client service person who wants to be more consultative has got to develop a point of view based on data. Case in point, P&G has been getting its growth through price increases in recent years rather than sales growth of case quantities. How come? Why? And any agency working for them should have a point of view about that and should be working, and maybe they are, you know, on scopes of work and marketing programs that will get there. But most of the account people that I encounter and who I ask, why are you doing this scope of work? You know, once I have my hands on it and I've analyzed it, how come you're doing this little bit of TV and these adaptations and this print and these online videos and this programmatic? How come? Well, it's what the client wants us to do. And that's their job, is to do it, even though the fees are insufficient and the people are frustrated. But yeah, but what problem is it supposed to solve? They say, well, you have to talk to the client about that because that's not part of what we're briefed for. Well, you know something? When that happens, you're in a commodity business and anybody can do what you're doing. And no wonder they can change you every 3 years. Whereas if you're a McKinsey or you're a Bain or you're a BCG or something, and you really are mainline working on the problems and finding solutions that add value, who wants to fire you for that? Nobody. To get someone else's cheaper? It'd be crazy. Listen, another thing quickly, Jen, I'll let you get back to
that. Go on.
But the consulting firms are paid five times the cost of their people.
I heard you say that. It's shocking,
isn't
it?
Five to six times, I'm told. And their people are more expensive, at least 50% to 100% more expensive. So go figure that. Let's just say they're paid 10 times the hourly rate, five to 10 times the hourly rate of agency people. Agency people are paid a two times multiple, 2.2, 2.5 max. Why? Because they're not adding value. Those man hours are not adding value. So, you know, for agencies to brag about how creative they are and how many rewards they're when they say, hey, look at how much you're being billed out at. Look at how much clients paying for your man hour. It's pathetic. So come on, give me a break.
Yeah.
WPP today, I saw listed as the most creative holding company. Hey, terrific. WPP is struggling in the marketplace in growing. They admitted that their creative agencies declined by 1.6% compared to last year. So don't brag about your creativity. Brag about the longevity of your relationships, the pricing premiums that you're getting because you're so good. Brag about the brands that you've turned around. Don't brag about the awards that other creatives have awarded to you at an industry conference. It's just wrong.
I am a little bit optimistic, particularly about my account management community, because I see a lot of willingness to understand the client's business, to push back on being an order taker and to ask the right questions. So I see that, thank goodness. And for that, I'm very grateful.
I agree with you, Jen. I think we're at a tipping point now because it's more than 10 years that clients haven't grown very well, more than 10 years. So I think there's an openness to talking about it. And let's face it, I think people know that the current mix of operations is not working very well. So listen, I'm happy for you that you're doing this work. And I think you can bring a lot of value to it. And I do believe the account people are frustrated. It's just that they're also held to the standard, don't lose a client. And so you have to take a risk. Matt Baxter had to take a risk. You got to take a risk. That's part of the business. No rewards without risks.
No, you're right.
You can't run a safe business and hope to be paid well and to add value.
Absolutely. I want to go back to the SMU. I want to paint a picture. There's someone listening to this probably an agency owner who has an independent agency of, let's say, 3 million, and they've got a good team, a good model, a good set of clients. And they're listening to this thinking, well, some of our clients are on a project by project basis where we calculate how many hours we're spending. Other clients we've got are on a retainer basis. But I love what Michael's talking about with this productization. What's my first step of trying to move more to a productization pricing model?
Oh, okay. Well, listen, it is kind of the only thing we really do when we start a relationship. By the way, almost all of our work, even if it's a client that's hired us, almost all of our day-to-day work is with the agency, because the clients always say, hey, if you want to know something about the scopes of work, you got to talk to the agency, because they're the ones that know what we've got. So what we do is we gather from the various account people running the different accounts what the current scope of work is, but not in whatever form they've got it. It might be in PowerPoints, it might be in Excel documents, it might be in Decideware downloads, because the client uses Decideware. It might be on scraps of paper. We might get it through interviews, but they provide it to us. And then the folks that I've got that work on this are very good at taking that stuff and putting it in my scope metric model. And all they have to do is they find the deliverables, and they classify it four different ways. They say, what media is it in? TV, radio, print, search, print below the line, print out of home, digital, social, et cetera. Then the next step is, what is the detail? If it's social, what is it? Instagram, Facebook, you know, what is it? Online video, et cetera. So you get the media type, whether it's an origination or an adaptation. And that can include things like, it's creative only, there's no production because someone else is doing the production. Or it's a full up, we do creative and production. Or it could be production only for those kinds of people. But anyway, media detail, origination or adaptation, and creative complexity, low, average, or high, according to some simple definitions. But now let's just think of that as four classifications. If we can identify the deliverable in our model and give it its classification, the model will look up its SMU value. We have a database of something like 4,032 different types of deliverables along those classifications. The model just looks them up. It's like, you know, opening the door and saying, oh, a TV 30. So it's in TV, it's a 30-second spot, it's an origination of high creative complexity. That has an SMU value of 1.64. Oh, sorry, 1.44. here's a TV, 30-second origination, average creative complexity, 0.64 SMUs. And then you get to a Facebook thing and it's 0.0009 SMUs or something like that. You add them all up and then you look at the fee and you divide by the number of SMUs. That's like the price per pound. Okay, but it's a price per SMU. And here's the interesting thing. If I'm looking at 10 clients in an agency office, the best client will have a price per SMU of $300,000. The worst of the 10 clients will have a price per SMU of $30,000.
Wow.
There's a 10 to 1 or a 6 to 1 or a 5 to 1 difference between best and worst. And that's using the client's data. And they say, well, how come? We say, well, that's because you're getting a fee. And it's completely unrelated to the amount of work you do. The amount of work you do is random, has nothing to do with the fee. Then the next thing you look at is how many SMUs does a creative have to crank out? So we can look at, we have 10 clients that we're looking at. We now have the SMU values. The agency has given us their staffing, client service, strategic planning, creative and production people. And we say, oh, your worst client, your creative, is cranking out 12 SMUs per head. And on your best client, they're doing 3. So you're killing them. And by the way, the correlation is if they're badly paid and they have a low price per SMU, they're going to be stretching the creative like crazy. So there's going to be a relationship between low price per SMU, very high output per creative in an unhealthy way. By the way, the right number is 5 because I invented the SMU and I fixed it at 5. So the average might be 5. And that'll seem okay. In other words, let's say an agency has got 100 SMUs of work and they have 20 creatives. the average might be 5. That looks good. But then if you look at it on a client-by-client basis, you realize that the average is the average for the agency, but it's not the average for any client because there are good clients and there are terrible clients. So look, the starting point is give us a scope of work and we will model it and we will generate. The first thing we'll do is we'll calculate the weight of these by client. We'll calculate your SMUs. Then we'll look at your staffing. Then we'll look at your fees and we'll be able to tell you what's healthy and unhealthy and what you can do about it. Now, Jen, I think in most cases today, most agencies are very underpaid for their services, and that's because they're doing too much work. And a lot of the work that is in their scopes of work is fluff. It's not work that's really going to drive the brand. And the client's adding it in because they don't really know what works. I mean, they're guessing. And they think, well, if we do a little bit of everything, maybe we'll find the formula. And anyway, we're not paying for the work. So what the hell? We're paying for man hours. So we can tell the agency how many man hours we can afford. And then we'll give them a scope of work across all media types and see if it works. And if it doesn't, we'll add some stuff next year and lower the fees. But, you know, it's very different when you discover that a lot of the scopes of work are really, they're way too big for the fees. And then you say to the agency, look, next year, why don't you share these findings with your clients and say that you'd like to take 20% out of the scope of work? And start the discussion about what you think is working, what isn't. So, you know, listen, that process of evaluating the scope of work, that takes about 2 months. And it only takes 2 months because we have to reconstruct it. If they had a great system, we could do it in a week, but they don't. So we have to reconstruct it. And then we charge for that. We sort of charge on a price per creative basis because we charge on what we think the size of the scope of work is. We don't know how big it is. But we do know how many creatives they have. So we kind of charge on a per head basis to do this diagnostic. And, you know, it's on a downward sloping curve. So we don't charge the same amount for someone that's really big, has a large number of creatives versus someone that's really small. But that's it. Listen, there has to be a scope of work diagnostic because we can't make any kind of a sense out of an agency if we don't know how much work they're doing. How else can we evaluate their fees or their resources? We have to know how much work there is. So that's what we do.
It sounds, yeah. I mean, this is the first time I've ever heard it explained like that. I know that project managers look at scopes and hours and try, you know, we look at targeted billable.
Oh, they look at Gantt charts as sort of, are we on schedule to get the deliverable out the door when they want it? But all the project management systems they have don't measure quantity of work. And I won't go into the boring thing about how many years it took us to get the scope metric system to where it worked. I'll just say this. For the first 15 years that we did our analysis, we would gather the scopes of work. We would gather how many teams they had on it. Because, you know, back in the early days, you knew how there were so few deliverables. You could count up if they had multiple teams. And we also gathered how much rework there was on each deliverable. We couldn't do that today. But I remember doing Toyota with Saatchi in 2014. And there were only 137 deliverables that the creative agency would do. Today, it would probably be about 20,000 deliverables. But then we could gather all this stuff. We would run our model. And if the model was any good, it would say it takes 31 creatives to do the work for the kind of work it is, the number of teams on it, the amount of rework that actually exists, that number of SMUs with all those characters, it would take 31 creatives. And we used to hold our breath. We'd push the button on the model and hold our breath, like, oh my God, I hope it generates around 30 or 31. We were never off by more than a half. And that was the quality of the SMU value, which of course, you know, Saatchi helped us, Team One helped us, Ogilvy helped us, JWT helped us, you know, for the first 15 years I was in existence. You know, we worked with them to get it right. Kraft helped us in 2005. American Express helped us in the following year, but we just got to the point where we said, well, we can't gather number of teams anymore and rework rates. It's impossible. We'll just use the SMU value as it is. We know it's valid. And so, listen, I don't have any question in my mind that it's not a valid measure of the weight of a scope of work by deliverable.
It sounds like every agency needs to do this, Michael. And I'm just wondering how accessible it is, because obviously we have different independent agencies ranging from, you know, not even 1 million turnover to 5 and above. But I'm just wondering, typically, and this is probably a wrap-up question, really, because I'm conscious of your time. I'd love to kind of, now you've explained all that, and I'm sure there are some agencies that would like to work with you. What kind of agencies typically can work with you, and what's the best way of doing that? And do you help them beyond that initial analysis?
Absolutely. Listen, we're working today with a small agency in Ecuador.
Wow.
Okay. We've worked extensively in Brazil and Mexico City, the Caribbean, throughout Europe, the US, Asia. You know, because the amazing thing is that despite the differences in cost and pricing, you know, and agencies work the same way. They really do generate creative work or media work in exactly the same way. So the resources are whatever they are. That's one of the things that I discovered in 1990. So listen, we've worked with agencies that were as small as $5 million in fees. We've worked with agencies, you know, where there's several hundred million. It doesn't matter. It's just how many clients they have and how many scopes of work they have. And, you know, what they're prepared to pay to find out. We can work on a brand as a test. We worked in Mexico City with an independent agency. And this was an interesting one. Small independent agency. I loved going down to Mexico City, so I did much of this work myself with my staff back in the States. We figured out the scopes of work. We could see that they were underpaid, and the CEO was a very aggressive guy. He was terrific. Fernando, I won't talk about the age, but Fernando, he went to every client and he said, look, I'm really embarrassed to say this, but for the first time, I know what work we're doing for you. We brought this guy Farmer in from the States, and you know, we've done this type of analysis. I know what work we're doing for you, and I'm really embarrassed because I think we're doing the wrong thing for you to move your brand. Here's what I'd like to do. I would like, for no change in fee, to propose a completely different scope of work for you and have your people evaluate it. And he said, okay, 75% of his clients took him up on that. The other 25% he fired.
Right.
I'm not going to work with someone that won't let me submit an independent score. All right. So, and he said he turned his account people loose. By the way, Jen, this was, you know, the best training in the world for an account person is to say, first of all, let's analyze your scope of work. Let's figure out what it is. You come up with a better scope of work, knowing everything you know about the client. And I guarantee they can do it. They say, well, we wouldn't be doing this. We wouldn't be doing that. I think this is a waste. And I think for the same fee, we should be doing less work. Anyway, that's what they did. And they got their clients to buy it. And you better believe that there were fewer SMUs, fewer deliverables in the new scopes of work for the same fee, doubled his profits in 1 year. And then he got bought by one of the big holding companies because he was so profitable. And he became a holding company executive who was unable to get the holding company, other agencies in the holding company to do it, even though that's why he had succeeded. So he quit.
Wow.
But it was a great story. I learned so much from him because I wasn't smart enough to think about that strategy. Analyze the scopes of work, discover we got way too much work, tell the clients one by one, and it should be the CEO with the account people doing it. I'm embarrassed at what we're doing for you because I think we can do a better job, same fee, and came up with a better scope of work that actually did work better. Surprise, surprise, agencies might be just a little bit smarter than their clients when it comes to scope of work if they're given an opportunity. And the way he did it, it cost nobody any money.
Honestly, that's genius. And I'm sure people listening to that story will be inspired. So thank you for sharing it. Have you got any final pieces of advice, a parting word for an agency owner who's listening to this?
Well, listen, I think for many, many reasons, many of which are outside agency control, they have been relegated. They have moved from strategy consulting-like with great creative capabilities to servicers with bloated scopes of work at inadequate fees. And it has been very hard on their people. And it has put them in a position where they can't do their best work. I genuinely believe in the consulting profession, of which I include creative and media agencies. What I'm sad about, you know, in the time that I've been in business is the degree to which agencies have lost that special partnership. And I think that there are gentle ways of getting back to it by taking advantage of two things. Number one, clients are not performing very well. Number two, scopes of work are bloated. They're of the client's creation. And agencies, if they put their mind to it, can come up with better solutions that involve less work for the same fee. And so I think that if an agency owner or CEO says, that's true, clients are underperforming and the scopes of work aren't great. And even if we do them, we're not going to cover ourselves with glory. We need to get to a better place. How can we get there that runs the fewest risk? And I think that the strategy that I just outlined that this one Mexican agency did was the best, absolutely the best. And the other thing is, I think that the client's performance situation need not rely on the clients giving brand strategic plans. This is analyzable from the outside. I've used ChatGPT to analyze the performance problems of a client's brands when I've had no access to their internal data. And you'd be surprised how much information is out there over the last 10 years. ChatGPT or any of the other great AI programs will give you a starting point. So, you know, you don't need to say, look, in order to become partners, we need your brand strategic plans and you need to share them with them and you need to accept us as partners. No, I would say agencies can assume, they can study that, can be done by the account people at a desktop computer. And then if there is air support for an account person at his or her agency by the CEO to say, we're going to move in a different direction and take more responsibility for scopes of work and start to get paid on that basis, let's start at the gentle way. That's what I would do. And I think it's risk-free. It'll involve a little bit of cost to come to grips with the scope of work. I honestly don't think people can do that without our help, but we're not terribly expensive, even especially for small agencies. We're not terribly expensive. And I think we're good at what we do. And we're fast and we know how to do it. So there's a lot of insight that comes across if you've got the scope of work for every client laid out. Here are the deliverables. Here are the classifications. Here are the SMU values. Here's the price per SMU. Wow, 300,000 to 30,000? Here are the SMUs per creative metric. What, 12 on one and three on another? How did that happen? So let's fix the underperforming clients first. And it's generally about, I'd say it's generally about 40% of the clients. So it's at least 4 out of 10, maybe 6 out of 10 that are in a bad situation in most agencies. And the really great clients are supporting all the terrible ones. Well, you want to hang on to the great ones and you want to fix the terrible ones.
Absolutely.
So anyway, that's my off-the-cuff advice. But really, I think it's so doable. I'm very frustrated that it's so hard to get there because it looks so risky.
Honestly, thank you so much for sharing so much value, so many tips, so much insight. What's the best way of reaching you?
Well, listen, they can link up with me on LinkedIn and send me a LinkedIn message. I've even put my email address and my phone number in my LinkedIn contact details. My email address is mfarmer@farmerandco.com, F-A-R-M-E-R-A-N-D-C-O.com. And, you know, all that stuff is on my website, www.farmerandco.com. There are a lot of ways to get to me. I wish it were 1-800-M-I-K-E or something simple like that.
A bit shorter.
But yeah, I think the easiest is to look me up on LinkedIn.
Okay.
And send a message on LinkedIn, because I certainly will respond to that. And I'm certainly happy to talk to anybody about what they think their situation is. Most people contact me and say, I think we're underpaid by our clients, or, you know, we have a particular problem, we're under review or something. And I say, well, you know, listen, we got to look at what work you're doing and see how we can leverage that to get you to a better place.
Absolutely. Listen, we will put the links in the show notes, Michael. Thank you once again. I'm absolutely thrilled to finally meet you. And again, thank you for sharing so much value. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Michael and will read his latest book, Madison Avenue Makeover, which maps out the transformation of Huge's business model step by step. And finally, if you are in an account management role or you're in charge of an agency account management team and you want to raise the value of this position, then please connect with me on LinkedIn at Jenny Plant or check out my Account Accelerator program by going to my website, accountmanagementskills.com. I look forward to speaking to you on the next episode.